Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:46 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And of course, today is March 10th. I thought we'd kick off and think about the banking sector. So, Silicon Valley Bank has collapsed. It was trading at $750 at the end of 2021, and now it's basically worth zero. Or they're very eagerly looking for an investor to come and just buy the bank. Well, it did exceptionally well between the low in 2020 and the peak in 2021. So that's a graphic representation of how well the investments it was in had done. And a lot of those were at tech companies in Silicon Valley, which of course is close to their name. Now, I think there's a couple of important points here. The first is that a lot of the companies that they were invested in were very interest rate sensitive. And then the tier one capital that they were holding was also interest rate sensitive. So they were hit on both sides, and then with people taking their money out, that really was problematic. Now, as recently as last year, they had $173 billion in deposits, and now the bank is dissolving. So a lot of people have taken their money out, and they liquidated their holdings a couple of days ago. They took $1 billion loss on that, and they've subsequently failed to raise additional capital. So obviously somebody is taking losses. Now, there was news earlier on today that it was a Swedish pension fund has found themselves in trouble. But what I think is most particularly relevant here is not so much that California banks are experiencing stress, and it's not. And of course, what people are looking at is any bank now that is any bank that's listed in California is experiencing stress. So PacWest Bancorp, where the headquarters are in Beverly Hills, is also pulling back in a really quite dynamic manner. Then we have First Republic out of San Francisco. Now, they have come out in here today and been very vocal, saying that we have a different business model and we're not in the same kind of business as SIVB. So we're more of an asset manager and a traditional private banking bank. So don't put us in the same, don't lump us all together. But there is no denying that it went up an awful lot in 2020 and 2021, and now it's been coming down for a year, and then there was a really marked acceleration this week. So if one were buying today, it's on the expectation that they really do have a different business model. But the share price does not support that view. It looks very similar to the share performance that we had with SIVB. So they're probably going to have to do a bit more proof. Now, of course, what this is also doing is putting downward pressure on the regional banks index. So it has pulled back in really quite a dynamic manner. And I think it's really quite relevant that there's only a couple of banks that are in positive territory this year. Well, one is Texas Capital Bank, and I happen to know people working there. And well, they're not investing in tech. And then you've got First Bancorp of Puerto Rico. Again, well, I think we could argue that there's a lot of crypto investors have placed themselves in Puerto Rico. So, but at least it's in positive territory. Then there are plenty that are trading down 20% on the year. And obviously, then the question is this a crisis going to spread? Now, we have people like Janet Yellen talking about the bank sector being well capitalized. And it's true, the banking sector is well capitalized, except for the fact that what the capital that they're holding are government bonds, and government bonds were trending down for all of last year. But Then we can think about what's happening right now in bonds. Let's first think, though, about the pension funds and the dilemma they faced. So, pension funds are very exposed to heavily illiquid assets. Now, in some respects, alternatives marry up with the duration expectations of pension funds rather well, in that alternatives, they're not liquid in the short term, but then the cash flows are attractive, the yield is attractive, and if you don't have to sell, well, then everything will work out okay. It's unfortunately when interest rates rise, when business models change, when there is some doubt about the integrity of those yields, then you're locked in, you're not able to sell. And that's obviously problematic for a pension fund. So they had a dilemma. What happened in the UK was that the pensions tackled this dilemma of almost zero interest rates and the demand from their pension programs for a return of about 8%. And what the UK did was they went for leverage. Now, legally, they're not supposed to do that, but they did it anyway. And they used financial engineering to get around leverage rules. And that necessitated that the Bank of England step in and basically bail out all of the UK pension system. So we had that spike higher in yields, and now the yield is starting to come back down. One thing that was very clear in here this week was that commonality that we had right across the government bond sector. So downward dynamics across the board. Now these are 10-year yields. Now let's put that up, say, for the German 2-year, where it's really gone parabolic over the course of the last 6 months. As recently as this time last year, it was trading with a negative 75 basis point yield, and currently it's just north of 3%. But this has been a quite dynamic move that we've seen today. But the move that we saw in the 2-year in the USA is really even bigger. So now we have a very clear standout downside weekly key reversal on the US 2-year. Now, as far as technical signals go, you don't get a better one than that. What we have here is what had been a quite consistent trend. Then it popped on the upside and went on to make a new high. So, in that kind of scenario, you give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Now we have a huge downside key reversal. So it went up to test the psychological 5% level earlier this week. And at that point, there were large numbers of investors who were more than happy to buy 2 years of protection at 5%. And basically, we've seen a huge jump in demand. So if we then just zoom in, we have it pushing on to a new recovery high and closing below not just the low of last week, but the low of the week before. Now, what I find especially interesting right now is you have people like Larry Summers talking about the potential that rates are going to go to 6%. And we had just this week the testimony of Jay Powell in front of Congress, and he was talking about the fact that they haven't made any decisions yet, but that they really have to get inflation under control. So it's we are at a very interesting juncture here. Now, when you have a move like this on the 2-year, it's I think impressive that we didn't have a bigger move in the yield curve spread. It was up 7 basis points, and it's a good sized rebound. But the sequence of lower rally highs is still intact. what the bond market is beginning to suggest to us is that the peak of the interest rate cycle is potentially a lot closer than what we're hearing from the Federal Reserve. Now, let's just put into perspective what the Federal Reserve is saying. They're saying that not only are they going to raise rates, but that they're going to hold those rates at elevated levels for some time. And that's not what the bond market is signaling. Now, let's look at the 3 months. So, the 3 month yield is still rising, although it was down about 3 basis points in here today. So we might yet see a little bit of additional pause here, but it's getting up to test the 5% level as well and pausing. Now we might yet see another 25 basis point hike, or we might not see any new basis. We might already have the peak in interest rates based upon that move we've seen in the 2 year. But certainly we're a lot closer to the peak. And the point that I've been attempting to make for most of the last 6 months to the last year is once you have an inverted yield curve, then you generally get a good stock market rally in between. But that eventually the lag between the tightening liquidity conditions and the health of the economy is closed, and then you get a deflationary shock. So when we think about the fact that interest rates have been rising and some banks are starting to experience stress, and that the large banks are experiencing stress right in line with the small banks, let's just put into perspective that Bank of America has $1.9 trillion in deposits and total loans of about $1 trillion and total assets of about $3 trillion. So we're talking about a very large bank that's in absolutely every area of the U.S. economy, and this is not a bullish chart. And we have the break of the trend, resistance in the region of both the 200 and the 1,000-day moving average, and then this big downward dynamic in here this week. Now, it's off the lows, and that's positive. We might even see some additional rally in here to just unwind the exceptionally short-term oversold condition. But this has a lot of work to do in order to question the downward bias overall. Then JP Morgan has deposits of $2.3 trillion. And a slightly larger loan book than Bank of America. And this was a big downward dynamic in here this week. Now it was in positive territory today. So there, I think investors are beginning to think, well, perhaps JP Morgan doesn't have quite the exposure to the growth sector, or I guess the failing growth sector that Silicon Valley Bank has. But again, this isn't a bullish chart. And then when we look at more of these money center banks, HSBC is down in a dynamic manner today and unwinding that short-term overbought condition. Now, obviously, this is a very different environment where the European banks rebounded strongly because they didn't have to set aside as much capital for losses because European governments spent money left and right to ensure that they wouldn't have to run out of energy over the winter. But now the question is, what's next? Because the short-term oversold condition looks like it's going to be unwound. And the largesse of spending money without regard for cost over the course of 2022, well, that's eventually going to have to be paid for. Now, what I find also particularly relevant here is that European gas prices today popped on the upside, and the UK price jumped from 100 earlier on this week to 133 today. So We're talking about a really significant move, and it's on the back of French strikes and less power coming from nuclear facilities in France at the same time that a fresh winter blast is hitting much of Europe. So it's increasingly likely that the lows are in. And I think we can see also that the 100 area is offering support. It's a rather big psychological level. So that would also gel with the supposition that we're not going to see prices dipping back down into the base formation. Now, I was shaken out of my natural gas long earlier on this week, and prices in the US are still coming back down. We're down 11 cents in here today. But if European prices rally from here, that's going to create additional demand for LNG exporters. And the Freeport terminal has opened up again. But when we think about, for example, Cheniere Energy, the bullish story looks like it's well priced in. It's rallied exceptionally impressively from 40 all the way up to 180, and now testing the region of the 200-day moving average. This is no longer a consistent trend. It has dipped down into the underlying trend and then it rebounded. So it absolutely needs to hold that $140 area, and potentially it's finding support in here right now. It stands to reason that if European prices are rallying, then demand for LNG and prices paid for LNG will improve from here. Now, oil prices are continuing to hover here around the, or well, still within this very tight $10 band between $80 and $90. And China brokered an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran today that they'll open diplomatic relations with one another once more, and that within the next 2 months they will open embassies in each other's countries. So one would normally anticipate that that should be negative for oil prices because it removes some of the geopolitical uncertainty. But prices were higher in here. So there's got to be a reason for that. Well, I think it really is all about the dollar. And that brings us back to the performance of the 2 year, because the dollar index is testing the region of the 200-day moving average and now pulling back from it in here today. And when we think about how safe haven currencies are doing, well, the Swiss franc was stronger today in a really quite dynamic manner. So this is the dollar pulling back against the Swiss franc and encountering resistance in the region of both the 1,000 and 200-day moving averages. Now, we've had an exceptionally volatile ranging pattern for the dollar versus the Swiss franc, but we're at the lower side of the range and the outlook looks negative. So there is certainly the potential here that we're going to see another downward leg in the dollar. The biggest fundamental support for the US dollar has been that rates were higher and that the Federal Reserve was raising rates in an aggressive manner to get in front of inflation, and it was being more aggressive than other developed economies. But with this swift contraction in yields at the short end of the curve, and the potential that the yield curve spread is going to start turning back upwards, which historically has been about the most bearish event that we can anticipate in markets. There's clearly the potential that the dollar is going to continue to go down from here, and we'll start to then talk about, and I think it's quite likely that discussions about the debt ceiling, the sustainability of debt, the kinds of spending patterns that are not negotiated and should be negotiated, those that are negotiated, all of these types of discussions are going to come back into the fore over the course of the next 3 months. And I have no real doubt that an agreement will be reached about raising the debt ceiling. But there's going to be a lot of discussion and very public, emotive discussion in the media about it. And in the meantime, it's likely that the dollar will go down from here. So the weaker dollar is helping to support oil prices. And then the dollar also is pulling back today against the yen. So having rebounded quite impressively and even pushing back above the 200-day moving average, then the yen is strengthening by a full yen today. Then the pound is steadying from the 120 area. And it's been hovering here around the region of the lower side of this range that's been forming for the last 7 years. And if it can follow through on the upside next week, then we can confirm that support has been found. And that would increase the potential that this is a failed downside break and that we'll see prices moving back up towards the 140 area. Of course, we also have the UK budget next week. But this change in the direction of government bond yields and investors willing to run in and buy the 5% yield, to me at least, that suggests that what we're more likely to see here is a weaker dollar. And then the Federal Reserve is going to be in a bind. Because with a weaker dollar and pressure to begin to stop raising rates, then that is going to start to put the question of the sustainability of budgets and the fiscal excess of the government back into focus. And that's, generally speaking, about the most bullish argument for gold that one tends to get. So prices were up $37 today and bouncing from the 200-day moving average. Now, prices have been ranging for more than 2 years, and we have evidence of both failed upside and downside breaks. The price popped on the upside right at the end of the first quarter in 2022. Then it broke downwards at the end of 22 and rebounded. And we're still rebounding. And now we're bouncing from the middle of the range. I remain very much of the view that before this bull market has ended, what we're going to see is gold breaking out to new all-time highs on a purchasing power parity basis. And we're still quite away from that. We can also, I think, just remember the fact that the price following the big move up in 2011 just about equaled the peak from back in 1980 and then retested it in 2020. That this just looks like a very big range. Now, I am fully cognizant of the fact that it has been going on for 12 years, and in that time we've had some exceptional volatility in gold. But if the dollar is in fact peaking, and we're likely to see a real secular change there, then there is obviously the potential that hedges against a weaker dollar will become more attractive. And gold is certainly one of those. But then, of course, it also will support commodity prices more generally. So, even though we've had really quite exceptional weakness in the grains and beans complex, wheat prices were a bit steadier in here today. Now, they are trading below the 1,000-day moving average. So, it has quite a lot of work to do to break the downtrend. Certainly getting a little bit of support here from the strength of other currencies relative to the dollar in here today. Now, if that is indeed the case and the dollar is rolling over, Well, it's going to lend additional assistance to emerging markets. Now, we're still in a corrective phase for the equity market. So, when we think, for example, about Mexico, it's popped on the upside and it was down today. So, we could easily get some pause here. But I suspect that it is going to be the biggest beneficiaries of rising geopolitical tensions between the USA and China will be the countries like Mexico and Indonesia, Brazil, potentially then also Nigeria, that will benefit from either friendshoring or nearshoring. And of course, India is very well placed there as well. But it might not happen all at once, and that they will be better bought following reactions. And it's very likely that stock markets globally will not be immune from weakness on Wall Street. So when we think about the S&P 500, well, it's pulling back down through the 200-day moving average. And this is a really quite dynamic move. So we, I think, should be prepared for the potential that we're going to fully unwind the overbought condition and the entire post-pandemic surge. And that could easily take the S&P 500 down to somewhere between 3 and 3,250 points. And considering that we're at 38 right now, well, that's between a 10 and 20% retracement from where we are right now. Now, that is entirely based upon tight monetary conditions. And we have to just bear in mind that interest rates have gone up exceptionally quickly. So I pay quite a bit of it. I watch Bread Financial quite closely because when I was replacing the foundation in my home last year, and I was going around and buying materials from places like Home Depot and Floor & Decor, I was being offered zero interest rate finance for 12 months or 2 years. And those in-store credit cards were backed by Bread Financial. And the thing that I was thinking about back then, most particularly as interest rates started to rise, was that everyone was being offered the same deals, and lots of people were taking them. I mean, Floor & Decor even had a kiosk inside their showroom where you could automatically apply for a credit card via the kiosk. And then you could print off a docket, and then you could automatically then use your card as soon as you'd been approved. So they make it exceptionally easy. Well, people have been paying, or they've been spending down their pandemic largesse, and Bread Financial is pulling back from the region of the 200-day moving average today. All the way through 2021 and 2022, the share declined, despite the fact that there was lots of demand for those store cards. So what it really tells us is that there is clear potential that the company is going to run into trouble as the interest-free periods run off, and then people are going to be under pressure to make the payments. And those at the materials for home improvement, and the cost of those can ramp up really quite quickly. So I think that is something that is definitely going to come back and bite the consumer finance type companies. I don't think that this issue with very high rates and a slowing economy is going to be limited to the Silicon Valley companies that were investing in the companies that were looking to IPO. And the what I find especially interesting too is that The IPO ETF is still trending downwards and has an eerily similar pattern overall to the ARK Innovation ETF, which is also still trending downwards. And then, of course, we have the SPAC index, which was also pulling back in here today. And last week, the cloud computing sector had popped on the upside, and this week it is coming back down again. What was also, I think, notable this week was that Salesforce has basically said they're out of the M&A activity game. And this is a massive change for the business because they've been buying more aggressively small companies than just about any other. And that has been one of the hallmarks of their business model. So the share price, having popped on the upside last week, paused in here in the region of that 1,000-day moving average. Now, what this definitely is starting to do is to beg the question. And the big question is whether we are now still in a secular bull market or whether this is now a secular bear market. And the way that we define that, or historically we've defined it, is that a secular bear market is a generational long process of rising dividend yields and falling P ratios, so contracting valuations and improving dividend yields. Now, so far, the companies have spent more time buying back shares. So we're also entering the lockdown period, or the blackout period, I should say, for buyouts, and that's going to be next week. So that's going to remove a source of demand from the wider market, and it's quite likely that we're going to see additional weakness over the course of the next perhaps 6 weeks. And then subsequently, demand will start to come back in as that blackout period ends. If that is the case, well, we should really be thinking right now about trimming our sails and not taking on a great deal of long risk. Because now let's just pay attention to what happens in secular bull markets. So, the number one thing is that markets, once they start to firm, they push back above the 1,000-day moving average. And in a secular bull market, a 1,000-day moving average will always offer support. So we saw that in June. We saw it again in October. And I think it is very likely that by the time we get to this time next week, it will be testing the region of the 1,000-day moving average again. Now, it's also worth reminding ourselves that in the period up from 2009 to 2021, we had exceptionally low interest rates. So, and we can just look at that. So, interest rates have risen considerably over the course of the last couple of, well, over the last year. From 2009 to 2015, they didn't move at all. And now we're at 4.75%, and I think by the time we get to the end of this month, we'll be at least at 5% and potentially 5.25%. And if the Federal Reserve does not see the downward pressure on inflation that they're looking for, well, then they will raise them further. But bond yields are already beginning to price in the potential that they're not going to stay high for long, and that the weakness in the wider economy is going to become apparent pretty quick, and then subsequently the Federal Reserve will have to cut rates. Now, it's also, I think, important to highlight here that they didn't spend too long at this plateau in 2018. They stopped raising at the end of 2018, and that was in response to the stock market pulling back by 20%. And then they didn't cut again until June. But the fact that they stopped cutting, excuse me, stopped raising, was enough to fuel a recovery in the stock market. But today, valuations are higher, rates are higher, and liquidity is tighter. So, and then, of course, we also have the inverted yield curve. And I think at this stage, it is useful to look at the 10-year minus the 3-month, because we're still at negative 120 basis points. And that is about as low as it gets. There have been startlingly few occasions when it stayed down here. It's also worth reminding ourselves that if this is a new inflationary trend, that even in the 1970s, when it got down to this level, it popped straight back up again, and there was a crushing recession in 1974. And of course, that was in response to an oil embargo. But then the yield curve spread got up to about 300 basis points, and then it had to tighten up again into the peak of inflation around 1980. So even in a longer term inflationary environment, you're going to get periods of economic weakness and deflationary forces. I think that it is more likely than not that the reduction in the size of the Fed's balance sheet, which has taken 700 billion out of circulation in little more than a year, which is twice as fast as it did in 2018 and 19, is going to represent a deflationary shock, and that we're going to have yields coming down hard. And that also suggests to me that the long end of the curve is more likely than not to contract faster. That was the primary reason why I bought the TLT, because I did not think that yields would continue to rally from here. And this downward dynamic confirms resistance around the 4% level. So, when we think then about the performance on a price basis, this increasingly looks like a type 2 bottom. And if we get upside follow through next week, we could quite easily break the sequence of lower rally highs and push up into the overhead trading range and back above the 200-day moving average. There are still significant inflationary pressures, and there is a war going on in Europe, and I think that this year is going to be a more difficult year because Russia is following one strategy, and their primary strategy is to use their numerical superiority to run down the arsenals of NATO. And that would suggest that it's not last year is going to be the pivotal time, but this year. By the time we get to the middle of this year, a lot of the supply inelasticity in the defense sector is going to be very relevant. And NATO countries, particularly those in Europe, are going to have to spend and spend aggressively to fund their militaries. And that's going to raise some important questions. So I think the first one is going to be for the aeronautics sector, where the focus has been on precision guided missiles. So Thales, for example, popped on the upside this week, and it's not overbought in the same way that, for example, Rheinmetall is. And there is obviously the potential that drones will play an important role in this conflict, and particularly when the artillery shell inventories start to run down. Now, Rheinmetall is probably going to be exploited as a provider of tanks and other vehicles. But then we also have the clear need for redeploying steel manufacturing. Now, this brings up the question of dual use technologies. So, ArcelorMittal is a global steel company with significant operations in Europe. And obviously, the Mittal part is in response to the Indian ownership of the company. Well, the share is right at the upper side of this long-term base formation, and you really do have to zoom out to just see how long prices have been going basically nowhere. Well, the reason for the big bear market was because China's excess steel capacity was flooding the global market, and then companies like ArcelorMittal didn't have pricing power. Now, the number one thing you need if you're going to rebuild your military is steel. You need, and then it's not just steel, but you need specialized steel. And of course, there is a good reason why, if I remember correctly, I think Warren Buffett was taking positions in Allegheny, which is now referred to as ATI. Now, that's a downside key reversal this week, and it's quite likely that it could come back down into that $32 handle. But then the chances are that it's going to rally from there. We'll see, if, particularly if the dollar is going down and emerging market demand starts to improve. We have to also remember that the strength of the dollar was a really significant headwind for growth in the emerging market sector. We've had several countries running into sovereign issues, like Ghana and Pakistan, because of the strength of the dollar, the dearth of US dollars, and then the weakness of their domestic currencies, and all of that contributing to a dire environment for speculation. Well, all of that reverses if we have the dollar starting to roll over. Emerging markets suddenly become a lot more attractive. One of the things that international investors like more than anything is to have the capital market, the yield, and the currency on their side. So that's, I think, going to be particularly relevant for countries like India. India is viewed by many military planners as being the bulwark against China expanding into Asia. And then they have hundreds of millions of young people that need jobs, and they're getting cheaper energy that they're buying from Russia, and they're more aligned with NATO, and certainly not thrilled at the idea of China expanding. But the Nifty index is not immune to selling pressure, and the more international that India becomes, the more likely it is that it will respond to international cues. That's a big change because historically India has been uncorrelated because its market was more or less self-contained. But the index now is pulling back down through the 200-day moving average, and it looks like a failed upside break. And India is best bought following occasional pullbacks, and it does get them, and they can be exceptionally scary, but they are almost universally, well, they have been universally very good buying opportunities because of the strength of the secular bull market hypothesis. And I think as we look at the potential for the dollar to roll over, well, we should also think about the Asia dollar index, where the dollar, where it rebounded from exceptionally low levels, unwound the short-term overbought condition, and then is rallying again in here today. And this index got all the way back down to the lows in 2001. So it really does help to highlight that the Asian currencies had a full round trip between the decade of outperformance and the rise of the global consumer and the outperformance of China during its industrialization phase up to the peak in 2011, they gave up the entire advance. And we might now be looking at a higher reaction low. Then the Latin America dollar index is heavily weighted by both the real and the Mexican peso, the Brazilian real and the Mexican peso. And it is miles below where it began the bull market in 2002 and 3, but it's been going sideways now for over 3 years. Now it was in negative territory today or this week, and steadier in here today. It really does need to push back up through the 42 level in order to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. When we think about the broader commodity complex, well, Brazil is a beneficiary if there is demand for steel, copper, and nickel, and of course, soybeans and coffee. Now, where would or what is the big bull market hypothesis for consumer or for, excuse me, for commodity demand growth on a global scale? Well, the easy answer to that would be renewable energy. And we can think then about copper. And it's worth considering that bull markets in emerging markets tend to correspond with a weak dollar and strong commodities. So if copper is in fact going to outperform, and we're going to have shortages of copper because of excess demand for infrastructure reorientation, then the uptrend will hold. And the price at the moment is hovering here at the $4 level, and we still have the sequence of ranges one above the last. But let's put that into perspective that prices have mostly been ranging and in an exceptionally volatile manner since 2006. And that entire range is above the underlying base formation. So if one is subscribing to the bull market hypothesis, well, then the bull market hypothesis is that we'll have a similar breakout and that prices will go from 150, just like they did from 150 to 4, they'll go from 4 to about 7. And I can't bring the, I can't drag the chart up and down. That would bring us up to a new high. And then subsequently, prices would not come back down below 4. So we would get a very lengthy range at an elevated level. And of course, that would then create a lot more demand for copper miners. So the copper mining index was down in a dynamic manner in here this week, and I think it is pricing in the potential that we could have lower economic growth. But then the chances are that we'll get a recovery. I don't think that governments are going to walk back on their commitment for zero emissions. And they're continuing to support the carbon credits market. So, carbon credits, despite the volatility that we've seen in stock markets, have popped on the upside this week and are closing out the week above 100 euro. And that's a new closing high for a week, as far as I know. So what that is clearly demonstrating is they also have bond-like characteristics. They're like zero coupon bonds because governments will restrict supply when prices come back down. But then the other point is that when we think about the outlook for government policy in an environment where the debtor nations are going to have to pay for the spending of the pandemic. They're going to need additional new avenues for raising cash, and carbon credits are an easy one. Then I think it's also just particularly relevant to Just listen to CEOs of oil companies. So Pioneer Natural Resources, which is a major producer in the Permian in Texas. Well, the CEO this week was saying that they anticipate that the Permian will peak at some point in the next 5 to 8 years. Well, in this service, we were very early in stating that the USA would become energy independent. And there is massive investment going on right now in building LNG export facilities along the Gulf Coast. And of course, that is on the assumption that gas production and oil production will trend higher basically indefinitely. Well, Hubert's peak eventually does get reached. And then subsequently, it becomes much more expensive to sustain production. So I think that is worth considering, that from a geopolitical perspective, it makes sense to build any kind of infrastructure that enhances the potential to be energy independent, because geopolitical tensions continue to rise. And the ambivalence that the USA is exhibiting towards China, and the talk among government agencies of, I guess, the revival of talk among government agencies in the USA about the lab leak hypothesis for the origin of COVID. And I don't think it actually matters whether it did or not. The fact that it is now being discussed openly is a reflection that government officials, they don't care what China thinks. And that's an escalation of geopolitical tensions. Now, in that kind of environment where there is a threat to the sustainability of energy independence, it just makes sense to build. And the Biden administration is talking about relaxing the law on building power lines. So that would then contribute to significant infrastructure development, but particularly demand for steel and copper. Then I'm very leery of Tesla. I think it's a very interest rate sensitive stock, and their cars are really not designed to last. And I think it's almost like cognitive dissonance that they say that their battery could last 1 million miles, but then the sunroof leaks or the steering wheel falls off. And the share is trending downwards. And this is in an environment where they're cutting prices for their cars in order to stimulate demand, and the economy is on the cusp of a recession. So I think that there is very clear potential for big bull markets to evolve in a secular bear market environment, but the outperformance of US tech was the defining characteristic of this bull market, and it does now look like it's rolling over. And then Amazon is another share that is trending downwards, and it's got significant issues. And I think, well, at least from the experience of Mrs. Tracy's business, it looks like they fired the wrong people in terms of managing their supply side inventory, because it has been an absolute mess for the last 3 or 4 months. So the share is certainly still trending downwards. This also, I think, helps to raise another important question. The subscription business model works well when you're the only one doing it. But I think after a decade where Microsoft in particular adopted the subscription business model, and then the performance of the share took off as they adopted the subscription model, then everyone wants to have subscriptions today. And that is assuming that consumers have infinite ability to absorb these cash flows. Whereas everyone seems to think that people will just buy new subscriptions and they'll ha lead an asset life lifestyle indefinitely. But I don't believe that's the case. The problem is that you can live an asset light existence in a bull market where you have a very predictable cash flow inter from work or from whatever source. But when that cash flow evaporates, well, then it's your hard assets or your hard capital. That's what sustains people through difficult periods. And the obvious example is that if you get kicked out of your home, you can live in your car for a while until you get back on your feet. If you get kicked out of your home and you don't own a car, well, then you're on the street. And then you have to go off and you've got to migrate to somewhere where you can do better. So I think it obviously that's an extreme example, but it does help to graphically illustrate that there is a value in having stuff. And the problem with the business models that have evolved over the last decade is that there have been so many copycats that now we're in a situation where everybody is looking for a slice of the cash flow from every individual. And that is totally reliant on the unemployment rate remaining exceptionally low, the employment rate being very high, and wages continuing to keep up with rising prices for those subscriptions. When we think about Amazon, Costco, Microsoft, Apple, Spotify, Netflix, Disney, and then your cable, and then insurance. And I think insurance is the subscription that we're basically told we have to buy. And they've been raising prices with impunity for years. But the insurance sector pulled back exceptionally violently in here this week. What I found particularly interesting, but it's really an indictment of the NHS, was that Aviva said this week that their business is doing great because so many people are buying private health insurance in the UK. What, of course, against a background where health care is free, the decision to buy private health insurance is obviously not a great sign. It really does suggest that the UK has the resources to get over its challenges, but what it requires is management and the very mature conversations between government, private sector, public sector, unions. The reality is that pensions have pension liabilities everywhere are exceptionally high. Social promises have been made, and this is true everywhere. And discussions are going to have to take place. Well, what's happening right now in France is probably an indication of what we can expect everywhere else. Now, what France is doing is trying to push through a higher pension age. And this is really essential. And obviously it's not something that is conducive to winning an election, but in forcing people to work longer and then that allows governments to improve their metrics, and then they don't have to cut benefits. But just a realization that pensions were set up because people were basically given a pension and not expected to live more than a couple of years. Whereas now, teachers can retire in their mid-50s. They might live 30 years on a pension, and then at a high percentage of their final salary. Well, I think anybody can understand that that does not make sense, but it's it's an inconsistency and a contradiction that defines a market. And that is one of the biggest lessons from crowd psychology, that it is the contradictions that help to define a mania. And usually it is the contradiction itself that proves to be the breaking point of the mania. So this idea that people can work for 30 years and then be paid for 30 years for doing nothing, well, that just does not make sense. It's clearly something that's an inconsistency, and it will eventually have to be addressed. So it's very interesting to see that the Macron government is intent on trying to hold tough against protests in France. But these exact same kind of protests are going to happen absolutely everywhere, and they are essential to have, because without them, budgets are going to be completely unsustainable, and the largesse of the pandemic is going to overwhelm the ability of governments to deal with it. So they've come up with new revenue-raising measures like carbon emissions, and then they're going to have to curtail spending. And that really means that everyone is going to end up working longer. Then all of that will happen against a geopolitically tense background. And in fact, a geopolitically tense background might actually make some of these decisions easier, because it would force the decision-making process, because defense spending is a matter of necessity and will eat into the budgets for everything else. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.